If you'll turn to Luke chapter 16, please. Do you ever feel like you have a platonic relationship with God? Do you know what I mean? Platonic. It's not a drink. It's a... maybe we could illustrate it this way. Let's say you're working with Eunice, and you notice that Eunice is coming back to the office after eating lunch with Theodore again, and she sees it. You know, you see Eunice, and hey, what's up with Theodore from accounting? You know, you guys are together all the time. Are you talking about marriage, maybe? You know, babies? And Eunice says, that's disgusting. Our relationship is purely platonic. Oh. What does she mean by that? She means it's not, but it's not physical. Like, we don't hold hands when we go to the library. It's intellectual, right? I mean, we get together and we talk about Plato, you know, philosophy, exciting things like that. It's just purely cerebral. There's no, it's not any kind of this passionate, fall in love, get married, have babies. That's for people who are barbaric, primitive. We've risen above that. We have a platonic relationship. It's intellectual, spiritual, pure. In order to understand where this platonic idea comes from, we got to back up about 2,500 years to a philosopher named Plato. Yeah, not the cartoon character, the philosopher. And Plato is well known for coming up with this platonic dualism. That is, and don't check out when you hear terms like that, because it's just that the world reality consists of two stories, like levels. You have form and you have matter. Form is essentially, both are eternal, according to Plato. Form is essentially that which is spiritual, rational, good. Matter is essentially chaotic, material, bad. If you just remember the good and the bad, you pretty much have it. Form and matter. Now fast forward from 2,500 years ago to 1,000 years later, and you can start to see how Platonic dualism began to seep into the church's thinking. For example, Middle Ages, a lot of people thought, if I'm really spiritual, I'm going to choose what kind of lifestyle. I mean, if you're really spiritual, you're going to move into a monastery or convent. You're going to take a vow of celibacy because you're going to give yourself to things that are really good, like prayer and meditation and fasting. And if you're not really spiritual, you're going to do what a lot of you people out there have done, and you're going to get married and have babies and raise chickens and, you know, feed your family and things like that. So you've got this kind of a different kind of platonic dualism, right, in the church. And people, I'm not just picking on the Middle Ages, because we think the same way today, don't we? Right? I mean, many of us think the same way. When we come to church and we hear a song that happens to really speak to us and we're crying out in prayer, we're feeling really spiritual, which is good. I mean, that's beautiful. But then when we're out building homes, crunching numbers, changing diapers, that's kind of earthy, right? Unspiritual. Do you think Jesus was a platonic dualist? You think he had a poster of Plato up on his bedroom wall growing up? No. How do we know that? A lot of ways we know that, but even look at what we've been studying the last couple months. from Luke 14, 13, 14, 15. What's the theme of Luke 14 and 15? Eating with sinners. And you can't get... Well, and if you look at the subtitle of that, Jesus overturns the table of social status and eternal salvation. What you see here is a convergence of things that if Jesus was a Platonic dualist, he would never bring together. I mean, he's bringing together burgers and Bibles. You know, he's bringing together the spiritual eternal salvation with, you know, what you eat for lunch and really who you eat it with. He's bringing them both together. Do you follow that? And he's saying, and I'm going to say something, you got to chew this over before you spit it out, okay? He's saying, if you're going to heaven, it'll affect the way you view the friends you eat with. Do you believe that? You say, well, what does eating pork chops with poor people have to do with my going to heaven? I mean, look at chapter 14. He even says in verse 12 that to those who invited him, when you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, nor rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back and you be repaid. In other words, don't live your life just to do favors for people who can do favors back for you. But when you give a feast, in other words, he's not saying stay away from food. That's barbaric. That's primitive. That's lower story, matter, chaotic. No, he's saying when you give a feast, who should you give it for? Well, rather than the people who you think are cool and fun and will make you feel good about yourself and raise your social status, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. That's amazing. I mean, Jesus is describing essentially in these chapters, and I know I'm trying to summarize a lot that we talked about, and we touched on this a couple weeks ago, in a short period of time. He's essentially describing two different worlds. There is the world that we're all born into and the culture we live in, and it permeates every culture. And that is a world that is a system of merit. It permeates every religion and every culture. And it's basically you hang out with people who make you feel good. You work hard to move up that ladder, whether spiritually or physically or financially. You do favors for people in order to get favors back. You pay people off. If you've traveled the world, you realize that's what makes the world run. Bribes, payoffs, favors, and often, sadly to say, church is no different. And Jesus says, no, that's a system of merit. That is not my kingdom. My kingdom is the kingdom of grace, where people who should not be there are there. And as a matter of fact, as Alan described about the Lord's Supper, the only people who are there are people who should not be there. Because anybody who thinks they should be there is still in the system of merit. Do you follow that? And so Jesus ends chapter 15 with the Father extending a relationship of grace to his son, who was a rebel, a bum, the younger brother, and to the son, who was the religious son, a brat, extending the same grace to both of them. Come into the party. Come into the party. In other words, come into this kingdom of grace that is not about status, and it's not about proving who you are by who you eat with and who you hang with and what you've done and always feeling like you've got to do more in order to stay in that favor. No, this is the kingdom of grace. And Jesus is saying when you live in that kingdom, it affects the way you relate to others. He is saying it even this strong. If you don't have a heart for the poor and the misfit, you don't understand grace. You don't get it yet. You're still over here in this system of merit. Because anybody who experiences grace and understands that I should not even be here, is going to want to, hey, you shouldn't be here either. Come on in. And you shouldn't be here either. Join the party. Let's go get a burger together. I mean, Jesus is saying, do you see how he's pulling together? There's no room for platonic dualism. There's no room to say, God, I just want a platonic relationship with you. I want it to be purely intellectual. You know, I don't mind going to church, and sometimes it goes long. I can put up with that, and I don't mind learning a few things about you, but I don't want you to start affecting my relationships or my, next big one, my money. And that's where he goes in chapter 16. Where we've been the last few months is chapter 14 and 15, where he uses food to communicate this message. And now he's going to use finances. Same cargo, different truck. Same message, different vehicle through which he communicates that message. And so the theme is kingdom economics. Like, how does living in this kingdom of grace affect your economy? Jesus transforms our view of money, poverty, and eternity. And you can't separate those. So, this morning, all we're going to do is introduce this, and we won't finish it. We'll just introduce it, talk about this fascinating parable, and then we'll come back next week and pick it up and get a little bit further. So let's read Luke 16, this parable, which is often called the parable of the unjust steward. And I want to warn you, or maybe encourage you, this parable is like a good rack of ribs. You know, it's kind of messy. It's hard work to get to the meat, but it is well worth it. Can you taste it? Sorry. Bad timing. Let's focus. Let's, all us ADD people. Luke 16. So he also said to his disciples, and by the way, the Pharisees are overhearing this. You'll see down in verse 14. But he said to his disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward. Stop there for a second. What's a steward? A what? Overseer, manager. Yeah, it's still not exactly like what stewards were back then, but it's that idea, a manager. And an accusation was brought to him that this man, this steward, this manager, was wasting his goods, was squandering his goods. So he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. You're fired. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I am ashamed to beg. Ha! I have resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. Here's his plan. So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. Huh? Did we read that wrong? So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. Whoa. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, or really when it fails, they may receive you into an everlasting home. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? Is that all clear? Are you chewing down that good, tender meat? Or are you getting bones? Let's break it down into sections. First of all, it's basically three big sections. First of all, the master is confronted. The master is confronted in verses 1 and 2. He's confronted for wasting or squandering. We don't know exactly what he was doing, but we know bottom line, whatever he was doing, whether he was embezzling funds or cooking the books or whatever he was doing, it was not in the master's best interest. The manager was not acting in the owner's best interest, which was, that was his job to do. So in verse 2, he is called to give an account, take an inventory, produce the numbers, and notice the manager does not try to defend himself, which means he's probably guilty. Right. Number 2, the manager is concerned. The manager is confronted, and then, of course, he realizes he's been caught and he's about to be jobless, and so he's concerned. Verses 3 through 7 describes this when he says, "What shall I do?" He suddenly realized he's in a bad spot. And there's several reasons why he's in a bad spot. First of all, his time is limited. The master is taking the stewardship away from me. And we don't know how long that is, whether that's an hour or a day or a week, but his time is limited. Secondly, his options are few. I cannot dig, which means manual work, and we don't know whether he's too weak, too old, or too soft, because he's been doing white-collar work for so long. His calluses are gone. He's got preacher hands. And so he's like, I can't go back to that. So I can't dig. And then option number 2, to beg. This is a shame honor society. So many rabbis wrote, it's better to die than to beg. I mean, that is kind of the worst thing where you could get to that position. So he says, I'm too proud to beg. So option number 3, to befriend, is a weird option. Now, what do you mean? And that's what he says in verse 4. I have resolved. I mean, you could translate that. I've got it. It's like he's stewing this thing over. I don't want to work. I don't want to beg. I've got it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make friends with the money I am currently over so that they'll take me into their homes when the money runs out. Brilliant! Verse 5 describes what he does. And we could take hours throwing around all the different options. Like, what is he actually doing? Is he just simply lowering the debt? Is he canceling out his fees? Is he canceling out illegal interest? You know, the law of Moses forbid the kind of usury that they often practiced. And so we don't know that. All that's conjecture. Bottom line is, he gave them big discounts. Look at one example. Verse 6, he takes 100 measures of oil, which is equivalent to about 875 gallons of oil, not gas kind of oil, olive kind of oil, which would be equivalent to the product of about 150 olive trees. So this is a big farm, and he's slashing what they owe. So these people are really, really happy with him. You can imagine somebody coming to you and just say, hey, I know you owe, you know, $10,000. Well, how about if you owed $5,000? I could do that. We could go with that. They cut your house payment in half. You would appreciate that. So, bottom line, verse 8, just when you think, ho, 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 And we're going to watch a movie of this next week, and I think it really does a good job to build that tension, because you're thinking, wait till the owner finds out. I mean, you are in deep trouble. And that's why verse 8 is so odd. So the master commended. That's the third section. The manager is commended. What? I mean, commended is good. He is commended because he dealt shrewdly, that is, sensibly, wisely. This guy is streetwise. I mean, he grew up on the street, apparently, and he knows when push comes to shove and his back is against the wall, he knows how to come up with a plan to use the brains God has given him. So he's commended. So what's the point? You guys get the point? Here it is. And this may not be the best way to say it, but it summarizes it. Invest your failing wealth in unfailing ways. Invest your failing wealth in unfailing ways. Notice, Jesus does not say, stay away from money. Don't mess with money. It's bad. That's lower story stuff. You need to have a platonic relationship with God and never touch any money. He doesn't say that at all. He says, use your brain when it comes to money. Well, what do you mean? Look what he says in verse 9. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon. That's just another word for wealth, money, possessions. So that when it fails, when this wealth fails, and it will fail, some of us may be more convinced of that now than we were a year ago, but I mean, it will fail. And not just it will fall, it will fail. It will disappear eventually. When it fails, they may receive you into an everlasting home. Wow. What does that mean? First of all, what it doesn't mean. This parable is not teaching us to be dishonest. Kids, don't go home. Tell your parents. I want to be a criminal when I get old. You know, I want to learn how to swindle people, to be a wheeler-dealer kind of person, because Jesus commended this person. Now, Jesus, remember, verse 8 does not say that the steward was commended because he was dishonest. He was commended because of his shrewdness. I mean, in other words, a parable is not an attempt to teach everything. It's typically an attempt to teach one thing. And if you try to take a parable and try to make a point out of every part of the story, you're going to miss the one point it's trying to make. So what is the one point? Here it is. Let's break it down. How it applies to us. Okay, how are we like this steward? Well, here's some similarities. Our time is limited, right? All of us have a limited time. And some of you may not see, you may not be convinced of that, but you're going to die. It may be today, it may be tomorrow, it may be in 80 years, but you're going to die. That means, just like that steward, your time, your stewardship, your management responsibility is limited in time. It's also limited in the sense of the possessions that you currently oversee are not yours. They're not yours. You're a manager in the sense of you are overseeing someone else's possessions. How many of your possessions did you create ex nihilo? Out of nothing. Even your resources, the brain with which you use, the hands that you work, everything is a gift. Everything. Your life is a gift. Everything you see was created by God. Sure, we can move around the molecules, but everything was created and given by God. And so we are stewards. And we've been given a limited amount of time and a limited amount of resources through which to invest those things wisely so as to bring about the greatest return in eternity. Do you see the connection? And so what Jesus is saying is, let's start using our heads here. Let's be shrewd here. He's saying, don't be dense. Don't be slow. Don't be passive. Many of us are extremely passive when it comes to money. We feel like victims. If I grabbed a bunch of people and pulled them up here and interviewed them about their financial situation, most of us would speak in the passive voice. I lost my job. I didn't get a fair shot. They don't give me what I deserve. You know what I mean? We're talking about things that are done to us. What Jesus does with the unjust steward, yes, there are horrible things that are done to us and wrong things. And many people have been through some very, and are going through some very difficult times. But Jesus is using the unjust steward to say, okay, you can spend the rest of your life complaining about what you don't have. What do you have in the limited time and limited resources to use and oversee wisely? Now use your brain. What are you going to do with it? What he's talking about is eternal budgeting. And I know some of you are like, check out. I can't even budget this week's grocery list. You know? I mean, we were praying about this last night, and one of the men praying with us is looking for work. And it's like, budget doesn't help when you have no income. I mean, it's fun to shift around nothing, but it still is... nothing. Okay, true. But the point of this story is, okay, look at your assets. They may be much smaller than your neighbors, but don't be passive. And don't just wait and see what's going to happen. Now, granted, there is a cliff on the other side where you can get into this frenzied, pull yourself up by your bootstrap mentality. That's not what Jesus is saying. But he is saying, people, look what he says in the end of verse 8. The sons of this world, I mean, people who don't even know God, are smarter in their generation, I mean, about using the resources they have right now to make right now better. Do you follow what he's saying? I mean, there are people who don't know the Lord, who take money that's been given them, and they make right now better. They're wise with the money they've been given. And they save it, and they invest it, and they make a lot of money. And that's glorious. Because people, if the only kingdom was the kingdom of now, they are brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But what Jesus is saying is, you forgot about the fact your time is limited. And all of that is good. I mean, it's good to use the resources you have wisely. But don't forget, your time is limited. So if your only budgeting process is budgeting for today and for next week, or maybe even for some wise people, retirement, we got to get into eternal budgeting. Let's talk about post-retirement. Can you imagine doing that? Sitting down with your financial counselor, saying, you know, I've been praying about this post-retirement plan. Like for your kids? No, for me. Oh. You believe in reincarnation? Like, are you coming back as something else? You want some money? No. It's the fact that my time is limited. My resources are limited. And I want to make sure I'm investing what I have today as wise as possible so it's bringing out eternal dividends. Now, this is where it gets fun, and this is where we're out of time. because I really want us to see, okay, what does this look like? What does this really look like? Because I think for most of us, we are convinced, let me just speak for myself, I dream of, you know, being able to do the big things. Wouldn't it be cool to have $5 million? Start an adoption fund. You know, I just think it would be so cool for parents who want to adopt a child, just come to this fund, here's the money. Ministry training funds, all those kind of big things. This is kind of weird things I think about. And Jesus is saying, wait a second. How are you using the 10 bucks in your wallet? Could you read the following verses? We don't have time to unpack those right now. And he says, if you're faithful with the little, then maybe you'll be faithful with the much. But if you're unfaithful with the little, with the $5 in your wallet, why do you think miraculously when you make it big, you're going to be faithful with that? This is eternal budgeting. It's a whole different way of looking at things. And it's not, don't leave here today. I know we can't finish this, but don't leave here today thinking, oh yeah, we're supposed to give so that we'll earn our way to heaven. That's the opposite of what he's saying. But he's saying people who live in this realm of grace and are free from the rat race, trying to impress their friends with all their new outfits, which are going to rot and grow moth-like, be eaten by moths and go out of style, they're going to have a much bigger picture as to what really matters. Let's pray. Lord, even though we just started this, I pray that you would motivate everyone in here to start going over and over this passage, asking for eyes to see, so that we can see the connection between food, finances, and eternity. So that we would not be platonic in our relationship with you and just think of you in an intellectual way or just experience you when we come to church, but that we would see you in what we do for a living, in who we hang out with, how we spend our time, how we budget our resources. We pray over the next 3 or 4 weeks as we wrestle with what you want to speak to us about. We pray that our hearts would be open. And Lord, continue to protect us as a church from being people who just want to learn new things intellectually, but really have no interest in living them. That's a work of your grace. We are so grateful for what you're doing. We thank you in Jesus' name.